Blog Talk Radio.
And hello again from Fox News in Washington. Today from the White House, we're on the president's patio just outside the Oval Office. President Trump, you've agreed to answer all manner of questions, no subject off limits. Thank you, and welcome back to Fox News Sunday.
Thank you very much.
Let's start with the surge of the coronavirus across the country in recent months. You still talk about it as, quote, burning embers. But I want to put up a chart that shows where we are with the illness over the last 4 months. As you can see, we hit a peak here in April, 36,000 cases.
It's cases.
A day.
Yeah, cases.
Then it went down, and now since June, it has gone up, more than doubled. One day this week, 75,000 new cases, more than double.
Chris, that's because we have great testing, because we have the best testing in the world. If we didn't test, you wouldn't be able to show that chart. If we tested half as much, those numbers would be down.
But this isn't burning embers, sir. This is a forest fire.
No, no, but I don't say. I say flames. We'll put out the flames, and we'll put out, in some cases, just burning embers. We also have burning embers. We have embers, and we do have flames. Florida became more flame-like, but it's going to be under control. And, you know, it's not just this country. It's many countries. We don't talk about it in the news. They don't talk about Mexico and Brazil and still parts of Europe, which actually got hit sooner than us, so it's a little ahead of us in that sense. But you take a look. Why don't they talk about Mexico, which is not helping us? And all I can say is thank God I built most of the wall, because if I didn't have the wall up, we would have a much bigger problem with Mexico.
But, sir, we have the seventh highest mortality rate in the world. Our mortality rate is higher than Brazil. It's higher than Russia. And the European Union has us on a travel ban.
Yeah, I think what we'll do, well, we have them on a travel ban too, Chris. I closed them off. If you remember, I was the one that did the European Union very early. But when you talk about mortality rates, I think it's the opposite. I think we have one of the lowest mortality
it's
rates
not true,
in the
sir.
World.
We're going to take a look. We had 900 deaths on a single day.
We will take a look.
This week.
Ready?
You can check it out.
Could you please get me the mortality rate?
Yeah.
Kaylee's right here. I heard we had one of the lowest, maybe the lowest mortality rate anywhere in the world. Do you have the numbers, please? Because I heard we had the best mortality rate. Number one low mortality rate. I hope you show the scenario because it shows what fake news is all about.
Okay, we'll put our stats on.
You said we had the worst mortality rate in the world,
I
and we have
you
the
had
best.
The
all right, it's a little complicated, but bear with us. We went with numbers from Johns Hopkins University, which charted the mortality rate for 20 countries hit by the virus. The U.S. ranked 7th, better than the United Kingdom, but worse than Brazil and Russia. The White House went with this chart from the European CDC, which shows Italy and Spain doing worse, but countries like Brazil and South Korea doing better. Other countries doing better, like Russia, aren't included in the White House chart.
California, locking down again. Florida, deadliest day of the entire pandemic. Hospitals at capacity in a number of places around the country. Shortages of testing. Shortages of personal protective equipment for nurses and doctors. A lot of people say this is because we don't have a national plan. You talk about states. We don't have a national plan. Do you take responsibility for that?
Look, I take responsibility always for everything because it's ultimately my job, too. I have to get everybody in line. Some governors have done well. Some governors have done poorly. They're supposed to have supplies. They didn't have. I supplied everybody. Now we have somewhat of a surge in certain areas, and other areas we're doing great. But we have a surge in certain areas. But you don't hear people complaining about ventilators. We've got all the ventilators we can use. We're supplying them to other countries. We go out into parking lots and everything. Everybody gets a test. We find if we did half the testing. With all of that being said, I'm glad we did it. This is the right way to do it. I'm glad we did what we're doing, but we have more tests by far than any country in the world.
But sir, testing is up 37%.
Well, that's 30, good.
I understand. Cases are up 194%. It isn't just that testing has gone up, it's that the virus has spread. The positivity rate has increased.
Many of those cases are young people that would heal in a day. They have the sniffles, and we put it down as a test. Many of them, don't forget, I guess it's like 99.7%. People are going to get better, and in many cases, they're going to get better very quickly. We go out and we look, and then on the news, look, if you go back to the news, all of your, even your wonderful competitors, you'll see cases are up. Well, cases are up. Many of those cases shouldn't even be cases. Cases are up because we have the best testing in the world, and we have the most testing. No country has ever done what we've done in terms of testing. We are the envy of the world, they call, and they say the most incredible job anybody's done is our job on testing, because we're going to very shortly be up to 50 million tests. You look at other countries, they don't even do tests. They do tests if somebody walks into the hospital, they're sick. They're really sick. They test them then, or they'll test them in a doctor's office. But they don't go around and have massive areas of testing, and we do. And I'm glad we do, but it really skews the numbers.
I'm going to do you a favor, because I'm sure a lot of people listening right now are going to say, Trump, he tries to play it down. He tries to make it not seem as serious as it is.
No, this is very serious.
75,000 cases a day.
Show me the death chart.
Well, I don't have the death chart here, but I can tell you the death chart is 1,000 cases a day.
Excuse me. It's all too much. It shouldn't be one case. It came from China. They should have never let it escape. They should have never let it out. But it is what it is. Take a look at Europe. Take a look at the numbers in Europe. And by the way, they're having surges.
Are 6,000 in the whole European Union.
They don't test. They don't test like we
test. Is it possible that they don't have the virus as badly as
we do? No, it's possible that they don't test. That's what's possible. We find cases. And many of those cases heal automatically. We're finding, in a way, we're creating trouble. Certainly we're creating trouble for the fake news to come along and say, oh, we have more cases. Look, we did something that nobody's ever done. Not only the ventilators, where we're supplying them all over the world. We did a testing program, the likes of which nobody's ever done before.
The head of the CDC, Dr. Redfield, said this on Tuesday.
I do think the fall and the winter of 2020 and 2021 are going to be probably one of the most difficult times that we've experienced in American public health.
Do you agree with Dr. Redfield?
I don't know, and I don't think he knows. I don't think anybody knows with this. This is a very tricky deal. Everybody thought the summer it would go away and it would come back in the fall. Well, in the summer it came. They used to say the heat was good for it, and it really knocks it out, remember? And then it might come back in the fall. So they got that one wrong. They got a lot wrong. They got a lot wrong. The World Health got a tremendous amount wrong. They basically did whatever China wanted them to. And we'll save now almost $500 million a year, which is nice. But the World Health got a lot wrong.
But this is one of the sharpest criticisms of you.
I agree.
People say that you talk about the world as you'd like to see it rather than follow the signs.
No, I...
Well, let me just ask the question, sir. Why on earth would your administration be involved in a campaign at this point to discredit Dr. Fauci, who is the nation's top infectious disease expert?
Because we're not. If one man from my administration doesn't like him because he made a few mistakes. Look, Dr. Fauci said, don't wear a mask. Dr. Fauci told me not to ban China. It would be a big mistake. I did it over and above his recommendation. Dr. Fauci then said, you saved tens of thousands of lives, more than that. He said, you saved tens of thousands of lives. Dr. Fauci has made some mistakes. But I have a very good, I spoke to him yesterday at length. I have a very good relationship with Dr. Fauci.
But sir, this weekend, your White House put out a series of statements, so-called mistakes, that Dr. Fauci had made. One of your closest aides, one of your right-hand men, Daniel Scavino, put out this. Have you seen this?
Well,
this
Dr.
Fawcett, it shows him as a leaker. And an alarmist.
Oh, I don't know that
why,
he's a
leaker. Why would
he's a little
that?
Bit of an alarmist. That's okay. A little bit
he's
of an
a bit
alarmist.
I'm an alarmist?
A little bit of an alarmist. Let me just say, Dr. Fauci at the beginning, and again, I have a great relationship with him. I spoke to him at length yesterday. Dr. Fauci at the beginning said, this will pass. Don't worry about it. This will pass. He was wrong. Dr. Fauci said, don't ban China. Don't ban China. I did. He then admitted that I was right.
But you made mistakes, too.
I guess everybody makes mistakes.
I was going to say, you said at one point,
it's one person coming in from China, and we have it under control. It's going to be just fine.
When you have 15 people, and the 15 within a couple of days is going to be down to close to zero, that's a pretty good job we've done. I think we're going to be very good with the coronavirus. I think that at some point that's going to sort of just disappear, I hope. I'll be right eventually.
I will be right eventually.
You know, I said it's going to disappear. I'll say it again.
But
it's going to disappear.
Does that discredit
and
you?
I'll be right. I don't think so.
Right.
I don't think so. You know why it doesn't describe? Because I've been right probably more than anybody else.
Then there are masks. From the first day that the CDC said that people should wear masks on April 3rd, you said you weren't going to. You wore a mask for the first time in public at Walter Reed this weekend. Question, the CDC says if everybody wore a mask for 4 to 6 weeks, we could get this under control. Do you regret not wearing a mask in public from the start? And would you consider, will you consider a national mandate that people need to wear masks?
No, I want people to have a certain freedom, and I don't believe in that, no. And I don't agree with the statement that if everybody wear a mask, everything disappears. Hey, Dr. Fauci said don't wear a mask. Our Surgeon General, terrific guy, said don't wear a mask. Everybody was saying don't wear a mask. All of a sudden, everybody's got to wear a mask. And as you know, masks cause problems too. With that being said, I'm a believer in masks. I think masks are good. But I leave it up to the governors. Many of the governors are changing. They're more mask into. They like the concept of masks. But some of them don't agree. I do say this. Schools have to open. Young people have to go to school. And there's problems when you don't go to school, too. And there's going to be a funding problem because we're not going to fund when they don't open their schools. We're not going to fund them. We're not going to give them money if they're not going to school, if they don't open.
Two points on that. First of all, what the federal government gives is only 8%.
10%. And you know what? That's a lot of money.
And you're going to take them. You know where the money goes? It goes overwhelmingly to disadvantaged kids and children with disabilities.
Let the schools.
Why wouldn't you just send more money so the schools would be safer?
Let the schools open. Did you ever see the statistics on young people below the age of 18? The state of New Jersey had thousands of deaths. Of all of these thousands, one person below the age of 18 in the entire state. One person. And that was a person that had, I believe he said, diabetes. One person below the age of 18 died in the state of New Jersey during all of this. You know, they had a hard time. And they're doing very well now. So that's it.
The stimulus bill is running out the end of this month.
Yeah.
The Republicans say they want liability limits, which the Democrats don't like. You say that you want a payroll tax cut, which even some Republicans are cool to.
Well, a lot of Republicans like it, though.
Will you only sign a bill that has those two provisions?
Well, we're going to see, but we do need protections because businesses are going to get sued just because somebody walked in. You don't know where this virus comes from. They'll sit down at a restaurant. They'll sue the restaurant. The guy's out of business.
Right.
So we do need some kind of a, you know, immunity. You do need it, just like you need immunity for the police, okay, whether they like it or not. You need immunity for the police. But they do need a form of immunity. You don't know if they caught it, and nobody's ever going to be able to prove it one way or the other. You can't put these, you know, the people out. Look, the Democrats don't want to do that because they're totally captured by the lobby of lawyers. The lawyers' lobby is probably right. The most powerful in the country.
What about the payroll tax cut?
I want to see it. I want to see it.
And if it isn't in the bill?
I'll have to see. But, yeah, I would consider not signing it if we don't have a payroll tax cut, yes.
Hot enough for you here, Mr. President?
It's hot. It's about... Well, sort of almost record-breaking.
You know, we wanted to do it inside. This was your choice.
But I wanted you to sweat a little bit.
Well, we both are. There has been a spike in violent crime in America in recent weeks. We've seen deaths up in New York, deaths up in Chicago, shootings. How do you explain it, and what are you going to do about it?
I explain it very simply by saying they're Democrat-run cities. They're liberally run. They're stupidly run. We have... forced them in Seattle to end the CHOP because, you know, we were going in that following day. You probably have heard it. We were getting ready to go in. We were all set. And when they heard that we were going, they set their police force.
Liberal Democrats have been running cities in this country for decades.
Poorly.
Why is it so bad right now?
They've run them poorly. It was always bad, but now it's gotten totally out of control. And it's really because they want to defund the police. And Biden wants to defund the police.
Sir, he does not.
Look. He signed a charter with Bernie Sanders. I will get that one, just like I was right on the mortality rate. Did you read the charter that he agreed to?
It says nothing about defunding the
police. Oh, really? It says abolish. It says defund. Let's go.
All right.
Get me the charter, please.
All right.
Chris, you've got to start studying for these.
He says defund the police.
He says defund the police. They talk about abolishing the police. They talk about illegal aliens pouring.
I look forward to seeing that. Meanwhile, the George Floyd murder has reignited the issue of racism in policing in this country. I want to give you a couple of statistics. Nationwide, blacks are twice as likely, fewer in absolute numbers, but in terms of per capita, blacks are twice as likely to be shot and killed by police as whites are. In Minneapolis, over the last 5 years, police used force against blacks at a rate 7 times that against whites. Can you understand why blacks would be angry at that?
Of course I do. Of course I do. Many whites are killed also.
I understand.
To say that. I mean, many, many whites are killed. I hate the sound, but this is going on for decades. This is going on for a long time, long before I got here. You know, if you look at what's gone on in Portland, those are anarchists, and we've taken a very tough stand. If we didn't take a stand in Portland, you know, we've arrested many of these leaders. If we didn't take that stand, right now you would have a problem like, you know, they were going to lose Portland. So let's see
okay,
what this says
see.
Here. Prosecution, sanctuary cities, incentivize illegal alien, expand asylum, abolish immigration detention. No,
that's not
well,
the abolish.
No, well, fine.
Okay.
This thing is many pages long. End prosecution of illegal border crossers. Support Deathly, and these are the worst things.
Sir, I'm not disagreeing with you on any of those. I'm disagreeing about defund police.
The White House never sent us evidence. The Bernie Biden platform calls for defunding or abolishing police because there is none. It calls for increased funding for police departments that meet certain standards. Biden has called for redirecting some police funding for related programs like mental health counseling.
This week, you said that Black Lives Matter and the Confederate flag are both matters, issues of freedom of speech. But in the case of the Confederate flag, there are a lot of people who say these were traitors who split from this country, fought this country in large part to preserve slavery. Is the Confederate flag offensive?
It depends on who you're talking about, when you're talking about. When people proudly had their Confederate flags, they're not talking about racism. They love their flag. It represents the South. They like the South. People right now like the South. I say it's freedom of many things, but it's freedom of speech.
So you're not offended by it?
Well, I'm not offended either by Black Lives Matter. That's freedom of speech. You know, the whole thing with cancel culture, we can't cancel our whole history. We can't forget that the North and the South fought. We have to remember that. Otherwise, we'll end up fighting again. You can't just cancel all
of
it.
But let me ask you this one. It gets to be more than just cancel. Well, maybe this is cancel culture. The National Defense Authorization Act, the NDAA, you have threatened to veto it. Because in the bill, and this is supported by Republicans as well as Democrats, it would rename Army bases named for Confederate generals. Now, this is a bill that funds military operations. It gives soldiers a pay raise.
Yeah.
You're going to veto that?
Because they'll get their pay raise. Hey, look, don't tell me this. I got soldiers the biggest pay raises in the history of our military. I got soldiers brand new equipment, brand new jets, brand new rockets, brand new $2.5 trillion. I did more for the military than any president that's ever had this
office. But
you're going
to veto this?
Because I think that Fort Bragg, Fort Robert E. Lee, all of these forts that have been named that way for a long time, decades and decades.
But the military says they're for
them. Excuse me. I don't care what the military says. I do. I'm supposed to make the decision. Fort Bragg is a big deal. We won 2 world wars. Nobody even knows General Bragg. We won 2 world wars. Go to that community where Fort Bragg is in a great state. I love that state. Go to the community. Say, how do you like the idea of renaming Fort Bragg? And then what are we going to name it? You're going to name it after the Reverend Al Sharpton? What are you going to name it, Chris? Tell me what you're going to name it. So there's a whole thing here. We won 2 world wars. 2 world wars, beautiful world wars that were vicious and horrible, and we won them out of Fort Bragg. We won them out of all of these forts that now they want to throw those names away. And no, I'm against that. And you know what? Most other people are. And I don't believe in polls because I see the fakest polls I've ever seen. But that poll is a 64% thing, which actually surprised me. We won world wars out of these military bases. No, I'm not going to go changing them. I'm not going to go changing them.
So you'll veto
them. I might. Yeah, I might.
At Mount Rushmore on July 3rd, you said that we face a far-left fascism in this country. And then you said this.
Our children are taught in school to hate their own country and to believe that the men and women who built it we're not heroes, but that we're villains.
You said our children are taught in school to hate our country. Where do you see that?
I just look at school, I watch, I read, look at the stuff. Now they want to change. 1492, Columbus discovered America. You know, we grew up, you grew up, we all did, that's what we learned. Now they want to make it the 1619 Project. Where did that come from? What does it represent? I don't even know.
It's so, slavery.
That's what they're saying, but they don't even know. They just want to make a change. Cancel culture. I hate the term, actually, but I use
it. But are they teaching people culture. To hate America?
Oh, I think so, yeah, I think so. Look at the professors. Look at what's going on in the colleges. If a conservative goes on a college, and look, we have as many as them. Excuse me. I think, to the best of my knowledge, we're sitting at the White House, and the Oval Office is right behind me. We have as many as them.
But who's them?
The liberal, radical left. And I'm not talking all, I think, liberal. I could tell you I like a lot of liberal people. I like a lot of liberal governors and senators. But Chris, we have a radical left destructive ideology, and it's being taught in our schools. And don't act like you're surprised to hear this. There are books written about it. And we can't let that go on. We can't let them change the true meaning of what we're all about. And that's what they're trying to do, and I don't want it to happen. Not on my watch. It's not going to happen on my watch.
Mr. President, you'll be happy to know that Fox News has a new poll out today, and you're going to be the very first person to hear about it. In the national horse race, Joe Biden leads you by 8 points, 49% to 41. That's, I think, 3-4 points slimmer than it was a month ago. And on the issues, people trust Biden more to handle the coronavirus by 17 points, on race relations by 21 points, and even on the economy, they trust Biden more by 1 point. I understand we still have more than 100 days to this election, but at this point, you're losing.
First of all, I'm not losing, because those are fake polls. They were fake in 2016, and now they're even more fake. The polls were much worse in 2016. They interviewed 22% Republican. Well, how do you do 22% Republican? You see what's going on. I have other polls that put me leading, and we have polls where I'm leading. I have a poll where we're leading in every swing state, and I don't believe that first of all, the Fox polls, whoever does your Fox polls, they're among the worst. They got it all wrong in 2016. They've been wrong on every poll I've ever seen.
I must tell you.
No, I'm just telling you. And let me ask you this. So on the economy, so I've always led on the economy. By a lot.
I know, which is why I was
surprised
by this number.
Biden can't put two sentences together. They wheel him out. He goes up. He repeats. They ask him questions. He reads a teleprompter. And then he goes back into his basement. You tell me the American people want to have that in an age where we're in trouble with other nations that are looking to do numbers on us.
So let me ask you a direct question. I'm going to ask you a direct question about Joe Biden. Is Joe Biden senile?
I don't want to say that. I say he's not competent to be president. To be president, you have to be sharp and tough and so many other things. He doesn't even come out of his basement. They think, oh, this is a great campaign. So he goes in. I'll then make a speech. It'll be a great speech. And some young guys start writing, Vice President Biden said this, 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 this. He didn't say it. Joe doesn't know he's alive, okay? He doesn't know he's alive. Do the American people want that? Number one. Number two. I built the greatest economy ever built anywhere in the world, not only in this country, anywhere in the world, until we got hit with the China virus. We got hit with a virus, shouldn't have happened, and we had to close up. We saved millions of lives. Now we've opened it up. Got to go back to school. We're open. We got to do things. We had the best job numbers we've ever had last month. We should have good ones coming up in 2 weeks. Look, I built the greatest economy in history. I'm now doing it again. You see the numbers. The numbers are through the roof. The Democrats are purposely keeping their schools closed, keeping their states closed. I called Michigan. I want to have a big rally in Michigan. Do you know we're not allowed to have a rally in Michigan? Do you know we're not allowed to have a rally in Minnesota? Do you know we're not allowed to have a rally in Nevada? We're not allowed to have rallies in these Democrat-run states.
Wait a minute. Some people would say that that's a health risk,
Some
sir.
People would say fine.
We had some issues after Tulsa.
If everything was gone 100%, they still wouldn't allow it. They're not allowing me to do it. So they're not allowing me to have rallies.
But I got to tell you, if I may, sir, respectfully, in the Fox poll, they asked people, who is more competent? Whose mind is sounder? Iden beats you in that.
Well, I tell you what, let's take a test. Let's take a test right now. Let's go down. Joe and I will take a test. Let him take the same test that I took.
Incidentally, I took the test, too, when I heard that you passed it.
Yeah, how did
it's
you
not
do
the hard, well, it's not the hardest test.
No, but the last...
There's a picture, and it says, what's that? And it's an elephant.
No, no, no. You see, that's all misrepresentation.
Well, that's what it was on the web.
It's all misrepresentation. Because, yes, the first few questions are easy, but I'll bet you couldn't even answer the last five questions. I'll bet you couldn't. They get very hard, the last five questions.
Well, one of them was count back from 100 by 7.
And let me tell you. You couldn't answer. You couldn't answer.
All right, what's the question?
Many of the questions. I'd get you the test. I'd like to give it. But right. I guarantee you that Joe Biden could not answer those questions.
Okay.
Okay? And I answered all 35 questions correctly.
You talk about how you're winning, campaign's going well. Why did you replace Brad Parscale? Isn't that
because he's a great digital guy. We all like him a lot. But I have somebody that was involved. You know, they were all on the 2016 campaign.
Right.
And we have Corey, and we have all the people. And actually, Steve Bannon's been much better not being involved. He says the greatest president ever. I mean, he's saying things that I said, let's keep Steve out there. He's doing a good job. But they're all involved. If Joe Biden got in, first of all, he won't call the shots. The people, the radical left people that surround him will call. Religion will be gone. Okay. Life, you could forget about that, the whole question of life.
Say life, you mean abortion.
Absolutely. 100%. That whole question, which is a very, you know, it's always been a 50-50 thing. It's actually trending a little bit more toward one
when
side.
When you say religion is going to be gone, what does that mean?
Look at what they're doing to the churches. They won't let the churches even open if they want to stand in a field 6 feet apart. We've had churches that wanted to stand in fields 6 feet apart. There has never been an administration that's done so much as I have, from tax cuts to regulation cuts to rebuilding the military to getting choice for the vets. Nobody's done the things I've done. Nobody. In 3.5 years, no other president's been able to do what I've done.
You're running in large part on the economy. You built it once. Now we have the coronavirus. You're going to build it again. And in fact, you had great jobs numbers in May. You had solid jobs numbers in June. But I want you to look at some projections. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office says the unemployment rate at the end of the year will be 10.5%. J.P. Morgan says in the fourth quarter, GDP will contract by 6.2%. With states now rolling back some of the reopening.
On purpose.
There are a lot of Republican states that are doing it, Texas. But
let
me just ask my question.
There's no reason for California to be doing what they're doing.
All right.
Except for November 3rd.
With the states shutting back the reopening, in a lot of cases, new lockdowns, won't the economy still be a problem for you on election
day? I don't think so. I think the economy is expanding and growing beautifully. Now, the Democrats want to keep it closed as long as possible because they think that's good for election. But I think the economy is doing very well. Now we're coming back, and we're coming back at a level that nobody would have thought possible. And by the way, take a look at a gauge, whether you like it or not, the stock market. The stock market, NASDAQ, hit its all-time high 2 weeks ago, and it's beaten it 14 different times, okay? The stock market, Dow, etc., is 1,000 points away from its all-time high, meaning very close. We're going to have a stock market, perhaps, on November 3rd, that's the highest in history.
I want to talk to you about Obamacare. Since the pandemic hit, millions of people have lost their jobs and thereby lost their health insurance, and almost 500,000 have signed up for Obamacare. Your administration just announced that you're signing on to a lawsuit to overturn Obamacare.
And replace it.
Why does it make sense to overturn Obamacare, people now are relying on? Democrats are going to say the man who's wanted to kill Obamacare is going to take away the protection for pre-existing conditions.
First of all, we got rid of the individual mandate. Pre-existing conditions will always be taken care of by me and Republicans, 100%.
But you've been in office 3.5 years. You don't have a plan.
Well, we haven't had. Excuse me. You heard me yesterday. We're signing a health care plan within 2 weeks, a full and complete health care plan that the Supreme Court decision on DACA gave me the right to do. So we're going to sign an immigration plan, a health care plan, and various other plans. And nobody will have done what I'm doing in the next 4 weeks. The Supreme Court gave the President of the United States powers that nobody thought the President had by approving, by doing what they did, their decision on DACA. And DACA is going to be taken care of also. But we're getting rid of it because we're going to replace it with something much better. But we got rid of already, which was most of Obamacare, the individual mandate. And that I've already won on. And we won also on the Supreme Court. But the decision by the Supreme Court on DACA allows me to do things on immigration, on health care, on other things that we've never done before. And you're going to find it to be a very exciting 2 weeks.
Your niece, Mary Trump, has written a book about you and your family. And one of her main points is that she says your dad, Fred Trump Sr., damaged the whole family. And here's what she says about what you learned from your father.
He learned to become the killer you mentioned, the man who needs to succeed at all costs, who will do anything to get attention, financial rewards, and to win.
Do you see any truth in that?
My father liked to win. My father was a very good man. He was a strong man. It's disgraceful that she said that. She was not exactly a family favorite. We didn't have a lot of respect or like for her. I would have never said that, except she writes a book that's so stupid and so vicious, and it's a lie. My father was a great, wonderful man.
Let me just ask you this
but
question.
This is not a person that I spent very much time with, very little time, and now I'm glad.
You've developed a pretty thick skin over the years, from decades of attacks in New York tabloids, now from the press here, and your political opponents here in Washington. But even for Donald Trump, does it hurt you at all to be attacked in such personal terms by a member of your own family?
It hurts me more about attacking my father, not being kind to my mother. I have a mother who was like a saint. She was incredible. She was an incredible woman. And she was nasty even to my mother. She's a very scarred person. She was not much of a family person. But look, let me just tell you, my father was, I think he was the most solid person I've ever met. And he was a very good person. He was a very, very good person. He was strong, but he was good. For her to say the kind of things, a psychopath, that he was a psychopath, anybody that knew Fred Trump would call him a psychopath. And you know what? If he was, I would tell you. And I would say, you know, Chris, I was with my father, and it was impossible. My father was, he was tough. He was tough on me. He was tough on all of the kids. But tough in a solid sense, in a really good sense. For her to say, I think the word she used was psychopath, what a disgrace. She ought to be ashamed of herself. That book is a lie.
Some people were surprised when you agreed to this interview, to sit down with me.
What are you going to ask?
Especially because of some of the mean tweets that you've said about me. Mike Wallace wannabe, nasty and obnoxious. I will tell you, after that one, my son Peter, whom you've met, called and he said, nasty, no, obnoxious, maybe. But here's the question. One of your beefs seems to be that I put Democrats on the show and I ask them questions. And I guess the question I have is, don't you understand it's my job to put Democrats on as well as Republicans and to ask them probing questions just like I ask Republicans?
I'm not a big fan of Fox, I'll be honest with you. They've changed a lot since Roger Ailes. And I watch people like Swalwell, who I don't even know. He goes on the show. He got less than 1%. All of a sudden, he's on being interviewed for endless...
Yeah,
hours.
But I interviewed Nancy... Wait, I interviewed Nancy...
I interviewed...
You sent one tweet after I interviewed Nancy Pelosi. And in the interview, I asked her specifically about the fact in February you were in Chinatown pitching tourism while the virus was spreading.
If the president underplayed the threat in the early days, Speaker Pelosi, didn't you as well?
Isn't that legitimate to talk to the Speaker of the House?
Look, I know you very well. I respect you a lot. I respect your father a lot. I thought he was one of the most talented journalists there are. And you likewise are a very talented person. I do think this. I think you are very, I think you are toward the Democrat side, which is okay. I mean, it's okay.
It's not true. Watch the James Comey interview I did in December.
17 significant errors in the FISA process, and you say that it was handled in a thoughtful and appropriate way.
Yeah, he's right, I was wrong.
But you make it sound like you're a bystander, an eyewitness. You were the director of the FBI while a lot of this was going on, sir.
Sure. I'm responsible for that. That's why I'm telling you, I was wrong. I was overconfident as director in our procedures.
You couldn't do as tough an interview with Comey. I'd like to think I treat everybody the same.
It just seems to me that you are very prone to be nice to the Democrats, and maybe I'm wrong about that, Chris, but it's an honor to be with you. It's fine. I love it. I love it that it's close to 100 degrees out today.
Your choice again.
Yeah, I know. That's okay.
I'm not saying you're going to lose. I am not saying that. We saw how you turned it around last time.
I don't think I'm going to lose at all.
But if you did, how crushing would it be to you?
First of all, let me just tell you something. I know everyone wants to know that because they'd love to see me lose finally.
I'm not saying that at all.
You know how many times I've been written off? Do you know how many times I've been written off?
I've done some of it myself.
I'm not doing it this time. Don't do it because...
But how crushing would it be?
And you know why I won't lose? Because the country, in the end, they're not going to have a man who's shot. He's shot. He's mentally shot. Let him come out of his basement, go around. I'll make 4 or 5 speeches a day. I'll be interviewed by you. I'll be interviewed by the worst killers that hate my guts. They hate my guts. There's nothing they can ask me that I won't give them a proper answer to. Some people will like it. Some people won't like it.
I agree with that.
But look.
You answer the question.
Let Biden sit through an interview like this. He'll be on the ground crying for mommy. He'll say, mommy, mommy, please take me home.
Well, we've asked him for an interview, sir.
He can't do an interview. He's incompetent. There's a number you don't mention. It's called the enthusiasm number. The enthusiasm for Trump is through the roof.
I have mentioned it.
Even higher than last time. The enthusiasm for Biden is non-existent. Everyone knows he's
shot. But the enthusiasm against you
is high. Okay. That's his only shot. That's his only shot. I agree. And those people know I'm doing a good job, but there's something in my personality that they don't like. Because, look, nobody's done what I've done. Biden wants to come in and ruin our country. Triple your taxes. He wants to do things. He wants to add regulations that I've all cut. And we still have regulation, a lot of regulation, but I've cut it down to a level that nobody ever thought possible. He will destroy this country. But it won't be him. It will be the radical left. The same type ideology that took over Venezuela, one of the richest countries in the world, they now have no water, they have no food, and they have no medicine. That's going to happen here.
Two final questions.
If he wins.
In general, not talking about November, are you a good loser?
I'm not a good loser. I don't like to lose. I don't lose too often. I don't like to lose.
But are you gracious?
You don't know until you see. It depends. I think mail-in voting is going to rig the election. I really do.
Are you suggesting that you might not accept the results of the election?
I have to see. Look, Hillary Clinton asked me the same thing.
No, I asked you the same thing in the debate.
There is a tradition in this country. In fact, one of the prides of this country is the peaceful transition of power, and that no matter how hard fought a campaign is, that at the end of the campaign, that the loser concedes to the winner. Not saying that you're necessarily going to be the loser or the winner, but that the loser concedes to the winner and that the country comes together in part for the good of the country. Are you saying you're not prepared now to commit to that principle?
What I'm saying is that I will tell you at the time. I'll keep you in suspense.
Well,
okay?
Chris.
And you know what? She's the one that never accepted it.
I agree.
She never accepted her loss, and
but
she looks like
can
a
you
fool.
Give, can you give a direct answer? You will accept the election?
I have to see. Look, I have to see. No, I'm not going to just say yes. I'm not going to say no, and I didn't last time either.
Whether it's in 2021 or 2025, how will you regard your years as President of the United States?
I think I was very unfairly treated. From before I even won, I was under investigation by a bunch of thieves, crooks. It was an illegal investigation.
But what about the good parts there?
No, I want to go this. I have done more than any president in history in the first 3.5 years, and I've done it suffering through investigations where people have been, General Flynn, where people have been so unfairly treated. The Russia hoax, it was all a hoax. The Mueller scam, it was all a scam. It was all false. I made a bad decision on Jeff Sessions, and now I feel good because he lost overwhelmingly in the great state of Alabama. Here's the bottom line. I've been very unfairly treated, and I don't say that as paranoid. Everybody says it. It's going to be interesting to see what happens, but with tremendous evidence right now as to how unfairly treated I was. President Obama and Biden spied on my campaign. It's never happened in history. If it were the other way around, The people would be in jail for 50 years right now. That would be Comey. That would be Brennan. That would be all of this, the two lovers, Strzok and Page. They would be in jail now for many, many years. They would be in jail. It would have started 2 years ago, and they'd be there for 50 years. The fact is, they illegally spied on my campaign. Let's see what happens. Despite that, I did more than any president in history in the first 3.5 years.
Mr. President, thank you. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Can you imagine standing up when you're a president saying, it's not my responsibility? I take no responsibility. It's not. Literally.
Those words didn't come out of our mouths while we were in office.
I don't understand his inability to get a sense of what people are going through. He just can't relate in any way.
Well, and one of the things that I have always known about you, Joe, it's the reason why I wanted you to be my vice president and the reason why you were so effective. And it all starts with being able to relate. If you can sit down with a family and see your own family in them and the struggles that you've gone through or your parents went through or your kids are going through, if you can connect those struggles to somebody else's struggles, then you're going to work hard for them. And that's always what's motivated you to get into public service. When we came into office, even before inauguration, we had seen a historic financial crisis. Irresponsibility on Wall Street had spread out to Main Street. We had to move fast, not just in 100 days. We had to move in the first month to get the Recovery Act passed. We're now in a situation where not only we've got an economic crisis, but we also have a public health crisis to boot. Tell me a little bit about how you're seeing the current economic crisis and how you're thinking about the economy right now.
Well, Mr. President, there's three pieces that I see. One, we have got to sustain and keep people from going under forever. There's already 10,000 businesses that are not likely to open again, a significant number of small business and minority businesses.
Right.
Number two, when they're able to come back, they not only are able to keep their folks employed on a payroll, but they're able to cover overhead. They're able to cover the additional expenses. For example, the idea you can open without social distancing, masks, tests, and all these things, that costs a lot of money.
Those are added costs.
They're added cost.
Right.
And they should be able to have that added cost to be able to stay open
for
the good of the country. But the next stage of this is going to be, if we're able to, if the stimulus can keep people afloat, then we have to deal with recovery. And the recovery is building back, but not just building back, as you've been talking, now I'm talking about, building back better. We have to change the way in which we deal with allowing people an opportunity to make a living.
Right.
That includes child care. That includes making significant investments in infrastructure so people can make not just a living wage, but a union wage, making sure we have build up an entire new public health system, and making sure everybody has health care. And well, now we have a chance. We can add a public option now.
Right.
But this guy's in court in the middle of a pandemic trying to take away the protection for 100 million people who have pre-existing conditions. I don't think he has any sense of empathy or any. I don't think he can associate at all.
You and I had experience dealing with health crises, public health crises. And in each instance, what you and I understood and why I have so much confidence that you're going to be able to deal with COVID in the way that other countries with our kinds of resources are dealing with it right now, which is smartly, I have confidence that you're going to actually listen to the experts.
Yeah.
And you're going to pay attention to the science. And you're not going to quit on trying to actually bend down the curve of disease and transmission rates.
When we left office, you had set up a pandemic office within the White House. We had people from the CDC, 44 people in China. We knew pandemic diseases, this wasn't going to be the only one that ever occurred.
And the goal was to create an early warning system around the world by creating international cooperation so that when you saw it coming, you had time to prepare.
Right.
I know how deeply you care about American families and that any loss of life that is preventable, if you're president of the United States, it's your job to try to prevent it. And one of the things that I think you said that's so important, and you understood, we understood this during the financial crisis, you can't separate out the public health crisis from the economy. Well, if you want the economy growing again, people have to feel safe.
What you did and what all great presidents do is not only lead, they persuade. I think what you did with Obamacare, the ACA, and what you wanted to do, to have a public option. It's the quickest, fastest way to get everyone covered. I remember when Bo was toward the end, and the only person I told the detail all the time was you, because you had a right to know exactly what, and he only had months left to go. And I used to sit there, watch him in the bed, and in pain and dying of glioblastoma. And I thought to myself, what would happen if his insurance company was able to come in, which they could have done before passed Obamacare, and said, you've outrun your insurance, you've outlived it, suffer the last 5 months of your life in peace, you're on your own. All the things that it did, that it was so profound an impact on people, it was like it took them a while until they started to take it away to realize what was happening.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, you and I both know what it's like to have somebody you love get really sick. And in some cases to lose somebody, but that loss is compounded when you see the stress on their faces. Because they're worried that they're being a burden on their families. They're worried about whether the insurance is going to cover the treatments that they need. I couldn't be prouder of what we got done. 20 million people have health insurance that didn't have it because of what we did. But you remember when we were talking about this, I always used to say the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, it's like a starter house.
Yep.
It's the first house you get. And it's not the end of the process. It's the beginning of the process.
You know, we used to say that, you know, this is a starter house.
Yeah.
Remember what I used to say? It's like Social Security when it was first passed.
That's exactly right.
Social Security when it was first passed was this narrow.
Very narrow.
Social Security now.
And you kept on building it up.
Kept building it out.
Making it better.
Well, it's a little, right. that starter house. They got inside the house and they realized, well, God, this is better than being out in the cold, number one. But number two,
yeah.
And then I said, but I got a guy out there banging down the house. They're trying to take down the house. And I didn't realize the reason I had this house is because of them. And what's happening now is that you have so many people now. I can't think of any time since the flu in 1918 that the public had, I don't know then, but it appears it had to be totally, thoroughly aware
right.
of how vulnerable they were.
Right.
Now you have people going, oh my Lord.
And look, you're absolutely right that it is hard to fathom anybody wanting to take away people's health care in the middle of a major public health crisis.
And offer nothing.
At a time when unemployment is in double digits. There's another issue that's been on our minds and was on our minds during my presidency, and that is the issue of race in America and how communities of color are policed, how police are interacting and oftentimes acting in ways that are racially biased. And after the George Floyd tragedy, what we have seen is this extraordinary mobilization across the country of people of every walk of life, every race, every creed, who say, we're past time to do something about this. We understand we're not going to fix it all in one day, but we're going to take this seriously and we're going to start now. And we had experiences with this during my administration. Our response was not to ignore those problems. Our response was we had a 21st century policing task force that we put together that drew police chiefs, academics, young members of Black Lives Matters, all in a single conversation, and we arrived at a series of recommendations that are still pertinent to this day.
We got through the notion that if a police department was engaging in a practice and a pattern that was in violation of basic civil rights and civil liberties, the Justice Department of the United States of America, the federal government, would intervene and stop it.
Right.
Well, you authorized to put in place a whole range of things that would increase what most cops, the guys I grew up with, became cops, firefighters, and you know, or priests. I mean, I wasn't qualified to do any one of them. The point was that they know they need more guidance.
And I think this is a process that we're all going through and we're all learning. And something that I've always admired about you, Joe, is you know, your willingness to listen and learn. It is a sign of leadership when you are willing to hear other people's experiences. It has to do with communities that have systematically been underinvested in. It has to do with hiring and the fact that, you know, if you get on the phone, applying for a job, send in your resume. If your name is John, you might get called back. If your name's Jamal, you might not.
It's about to be able to accumulate wealth. It's about being able to be in a position. You know better than I do, but I've watched it my whole life working in the city. Black entrepreneurs are as successful as white entrepreneurs, given a shot in the same circumstance.
We're in a moment right now. My daughters, your granddaughters, have been involved in this moment.
Best
in,
friends.
in which this next generation saying, we have beliefs in all people being equal, and we don't see that operating out there. We're going to do something about it.
Yep.
And I think the key right now, and this is why I have so much confidence in your administration, wanting to be a partner in harnessing that energy and bringing about concrete reforms, concrete steps, not just in the criminal justice system, not just with respect to policing, but also with respect to investment, jobs, business development, is going to send a signal of decency and regard and concern and community around the country. Because policy is important, laws are important, budgets are important. But you know what's important also is what kind of values are you communicating?
Bingo.
And if we want to create a world that we want our kids and grandkids to grow up in, then we're going to have to do a whole lot better than we're doing
right
now.
We've got a hell of an opportunity.
And everybody's going to have to be involved.
We've got a hell of an opportunity.
Right.
Because look what's happened. You got 70% of the American people saying we got to do something about this.
Right.
I'm not just talking about police.
Yeah. And that's a big change from even when
it's a gigantic change. And let me tell you my thesis of why. There's two ways in which presidents motivate people. By doing something really ignobling, important, and people go, oh, or to do something really bad. This guy has generated a sense out there that people are waking up to that he ran by deliberately dividing people from the moment he came down that escalator. And I think people are now going, I don't want my kid growing up that way.
You know what it's like as much as anybody to be in the White House during a crisis. You know what it's like to have to get laws passed through Congress. You know what it's like to deal with foreign leaders. You know what it's like and how lonely it can be to make tough decisions where not every decision is going to be perfect, but you got to make them and to take responsibility for it. I've seen you with families that have gone through tragedies. And the thing I've got confidence in, Joe, is your heart and your character and the fact that you are going to be able to reassemble the kind of government that cares about people and brings people together. And for all the specific policies that we're going to need, more than anything, it's just that basic decency and an understanding about what's best in America that I think people are going to be hungry for. Looking forward to working with you to do whatever I can to help. And I have confidence in your commitment to making sure that we seize this moment that we have right now.
Thank you, and I have faith in the American people.